Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
This is Mikey McGovern, and you're listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, a podcast on the New Books Network. Joanna Raden, Associate Professor of History of Medicine and History at Yale University, is a brilliant and engaging scholar, and I had the pleasure of getting to chat with her about her first book, Life on Ice, A History of New Uses for Cold Blood, published in 2017 by the University of Chicago Press. The book follows the story of cryobiology, the study of life at low temperatures, as it was put to use in field research on human subjects across the globe. In other words, it's a history of blood banking. But Raden shows how blood-oriented anthropologists and geneticists in the Cold War actually operated under two different temporalities of salvage. In the first, geneticists and epidemiologists sought out blood samples to exploit imagined inborn genetic resistance to new diseases, a future-oriented approach. In the second, anthropologists worked to capture a rapidly receding past by collecting blood from so-called primitive societies to create a kind of biological baseline of human development. Raden also attends to the ethics inherent in the practice of extracting and circulating blood, and highlights work being done to re-engage indigenous communities beyond mere repatriation of vital materials. Raden is a fluid thinker, and the tide of her words was stemmed into a freeze by our internet connection, but once in our conversation. So nonetheless, hearing her speak is a real treat, and I hope you enjoy this as much as I did. I began by asking Raden more about her background, and I have to say that she may be the first person to have told me they were pursuing a PhD in STS in order to start a business.
I have to go back, at least to my undergrad when I studied science communication. And there I had a real interest in, fundamental questions about how people with expertise about science are able or not able to share that with people who have decision-making power. So kind of classic issues of expertise. And I went out into the real world to work for a while. And one of the places where I was working, I was actually doing the work of being a risk communication specialist, working for a media relations group that represented a number of public health and global health clients, including the CDC, Center for STDs, HIV and TB, as well as the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And it was a really fascinating opportunity to see this invisible layer, or a layer that's invisible to most people, in between the production of epidemiological information and the ways in which that gets packaged and disseminated. And it was there, spending time kind of poring over epidemiological data and thinking about population health, I started to get really interested in how the messages that I had gotten about science and in particular medicine and public health risks didn't seem to follow naturally from the data that I was looking at. And so I'd had just a little bit enough of a background in science studies to think, well, you know, if I went back and I got a degree, you know, maybe I could start my own company and do this even better. So that was the plan. And I wound up going to Penn for history and sociology of science, where I thought, you know, okay, I'm going to really understand more about how these complex socio-technical systems, I didn't know that term, I learned that in graduate school, worked. And that was the master plan. And right when I started graduate school, I got really fascinated with a project called the Genographic Project, which was this early foray into consumer genomics, where people were being invited to send, you know, their spit in exchange to find out like who they really were and where they came from. And I thought, oh, this is really interesting. This is a kind of citizen science. This is a form of participation, you know, in science, and I'm going to learn about this. And this will be a great case study for thinking about the kinds of, you know, things that I might want to do. But before I knew it, I was, you know, deep into the science of how it was possible to take someone like me and my spit and my DNA and compare it to the DNA of people that I was never going to meet and wouldn't have considered kin. And that was going to tell me who I really was. And it was doing that work and kind of scratching at that question that drew blood. And I wound up thinking and discovering that there were, you know, freezers filled with blood samples from indigenous peoples from around the world that were being put to work for purposes that the people who had donated those blood samples weren't necessarily interested in the outcome and probably had very little awareness of how that was going to be used. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to write my dissertation about the history of human biological variation and the history of that kind of effort. I hadn't planned to think about freezing per se, but when I went and started doing early research about who these scientists were that had originally collected blood and tried to make these kinds of connections, I was surprised and perplexed to find out how fixated they were on this then relatively new technology of freezing. And the more I encountered it, the more I got fascinated with freezing too. Why was it that, you know, people believed that freezing blood was going to enable some sort of snapshot in time? And it made me think back to the time I'd spent at the CDC and the ways in which I knew there were massive collections of human tissues that were being used for all kinds of public health problems. And thinking about the freezer and this practice of freezing and thawing gave me a completely different way to understand what life was, how we could think about life and time. And before I knew it, the dream of sort of starting my own, you know, company had completely transformed into really just being seduced by these fundamental questions about the nature of life and its limits and who gets to decide. So that's my current going narrative about how I got from point A to point B.
The book is grounded in an analysis of refrigeration as a form of technoscience, which was a marked departure from the consumer applications that preceded it. I asked Raiden to unpack how she followed this new technology and how it allows her to trace the relationship between temperature and time that ties her narrative together.
Great. So I was lucky enough in graduate school to study with Ruth Schwartz Cowan, who might be known to some of the listeners, well, for many who will be known to many listeners, but who might be known for a little article she wrote called How the Refrigerator Got Its Hum. Thinking about refrigeration, when I came across this stuff in the journals, I was primed already to be thinking about the technology that made it possible. And I thought, oh, refrigeration, freezing. I'll just, you know, I know all the stuff that's been written about household refrigeration. I'll just go to the library and I'll get the best book on the history of scientific refrigeration. And then I'll be done. And it turned out I had to write it because it didn't exist. And into that mix of thinking about technology, I also benefited from getting to study with John Tresh, who at that time was finishing his book on the Romantic Machine and thinking about, you know, how our interactions with our machines are more complicated than what, a Heideggerian interpretation would have us believe. Like, and this seemed like such an amazing opportunity to really think seriously. And John and I talked a lot about how to do that as an opportunity to understand how we might have different understandings of what it means to use technologies in the realm of biomedicine. And what has surprised me is that we have some really excellent work on the history of technology, and it hasn't really gotten a hold in the history of medicine in the ways that it's so possible. And so I hoped that by foregrounding the technology, not only would I get at different dimensions of the story, but that I would be able to demonstrate how it's not possible really to understand the history of modern medicine without paying attention to technologies, and not just medical devices, but infrastructure. And we could get beyond just the kind of doctor-patient interaction to start thinking much more broadly about how the ways we understand something as intimate as who we are could be shaped by a technology seeming as innocuous and resistant to analysis as a freezer. And I just was really attracted to the challenge of figuring technology in that way in this story. The other question you had about temperature and time, that's something that it took me a while to really appreciate just how powerful that relationship was. I mean, the thermodynamic potential was there from the beginning in looking at the history of refrigeration and going all the way back to the 19th century and thermodynamic theories about entropy and decay and dissipation. And in a story that was all about efforts to overcome decay and resist decay, I got hypersensitized to the ways in which that language was also taking place metaphorically. So, you know, not only was the freezer situated as a way to create a kind of form of suspended animation for tissue itself, because I was talking about efforts in particular to collect blood from members of indigenous communities, I was able to really think differently about certain anthropological theories that had always made me uncomfortable. Like, why did Claude Lévi-Strauss have this idea of hot and cold societies, and that indigenous peoples were supposedly cold, not because they had lower temperatures, but because of the way they resisted innovation and transformation? And so thinking about temperature and time really allowed me to understand a kind of post-war thermal politics in the atomic era, when temperatures are being augmented radically and people are really confused about what this means, and they're reaching for new kinds of language to make sense of how humans should think about themselves in time. What are the new potentials of life? What does it mean to be human, and what is it going to mean? And this is before anyone's talking about the Anthropocene, before anyone's talking about climate change and the ways we talk about it now. But you could see in the way that people regarded both a small vial of blood as well as a potentially disappearing indigenous community, the anxieties are projected both into the technology and extended into the social world. And that just, to my mind, seemed like something that I hadn't encountered before in the histories of science, medicine, technology I had encountered, but helped me see a little bit further into connections about Cold War science and medicine, and even how we take for granted questions about what it means to be alive.
I asked her to elaborate on what is so special about blood versus, say, DNA, which any molecular biologist knows you can leave out on the bench overnight without it getting spoiled.
That's such a great question. And there are so many facets to answer, but the first thing that springs to mind when you ask it is that blood is so protean. And you go back to even the medieval era and people like Carolyn Bynum, who has, you know, this amazing work on blood and relics and the ways that blood gets endowed with meaning and seems to hold more than is ever going to be detectable. I think that idea very much was in the minds of the scientists who were collecting blood. They were collecting lots of other things too. They were collecting, hair samples and in some cases stool samples. They were doing fingerprints and all kinds of anthropometric measurements. But one scientist kind of put his finger on, he said, you know, blood is the most important specimen we collect. And part of it had to do with the fact that this was the early days of molecular biology. So nobody was really even talking about DNA at all. Nobody was saying, oh, we're going to collect this blood and one day we'll be able to sequence the DNA that is contained within. Nobody said that. They talked about trying to get the full genetic picture, but it wasn't clear how they were going to do that. And what was obvious to them is that molecular biology was producing new kinds of blood group studies. It was producing new kinds of proteins that could be studied. And so there was this real faith that in time, blood would enable scientists to answer questions they hadn't even figured out how to ask. And they knew that there was more in the blood that they could detect. They couldn't say what it was, but they believed that it was there. And for me, what was really exciting was when I pieced together the story about Basil Luye, the Catholic priest, who was one of the progenitors of cryobiology, the science of freezing life. Because here you have this Catholic priest who gradually comes around to blood as the ideal experimental material for stopping and starting life. And you see that these collections of blood come to be like secular reliquaries that can perhaps perform scientific miracles. They're only miracles because they exist in the future. And by the time they occur, they won't be miracles anymore. And so there is that actual persistence of something miraculous being able to be revealed from blood. And this is what I talk about in terms of latency. Latency both as a kind of suspended animation, but also a concealed potential, the sort of cryptic dimensions of what can be revealed. Now, that's from a kind of technical level, but there's another really important way that blood matters for my story, which has to do with race. And if you look at the history of race writ large, blood is the fluid, is the language that in particular Americans, but around the world, but in particular Americans have used to adjudicate race. Think about the one drop rule of, you know, if you have one drop of, you know, African-American blood, then you're Black. Or think about blood quantum as a way of deciding who's in and who's out in Native American communities. And so blood had always or had long been this racial marker, this way of determining the essence of who someone really was. So the idea that these scientists would focus and be so excited about the ability to preserve this otherwise ephemeral material made sense when you put those two facets together, that there was some kind of racial thinking going on about what the utility of blood was, but also some kind of thinking about the concealed potential of even other forms of life that might be within this blood. So DNA, to come back around, you're absolutely right. It's totally hardy. It doesn't need to be frozen. It's almost, when you think about freezing DNA, the freezer becomes like this Baroque technology. It's like so excessive, you know, why would you be doing that? But partly what's at stake, and this is becomes a big issue when people talk about, maybe, you know, we should just sequence all the samples and get rid of the blood. And that would, you know, solve some of these ethical issues or questions about ownership and property. The problem there from the perspective of scientists is that what you're getting out of these samples is much more than DNA. DNA is, you know, what everyone's really excited about right now. But what if there's something else that we don't even know? So there's this constant question of like the future. When does the future arrive? And you wouldn't want to get rid of the sample. And one of the ways I kind of think about it is when we talk about in library science, like digitizing the books or digitizing, say, the scientific journals. As historians, we're like, no, don't throw the journal away, because we want the advertisements. We want the back matter. We want maybe the person who scrawled some notes in the corner. There's so much more information there than just what is presented as the valuable content. And I think the same thing is at play with blood. It's such a kind of information dense fluid that it becomes very difficult for scientists to think about reducing it merely to DNA, though DNA is, of course, incredibly valuable thing to try to get out of blood.
Life on Ice can be read as a history of Cold War biology, but it is also a reflection on data and archives. One of my favorite parts of the book is when a statistician criticizes the collect first, hypothesize later mentality of Raven's actors. And I asked her to talk a bit about how different communities of scientists worked with this data, and the downstream epistemic consequences of collection practices.
Yeah, that's another really awesome question, in particular, because one of the things that's been really exciting about working on this project is the ways it's led me into domains that I didn't know that I was going to be interested in. So increasingly, I find myself in conversations about big data and the history of data. And so Newton Morton's kind of chalk criticism that this whole collect now, think later approach is bad and is going to lead to, you know, meaningless outcomes, actually presages some of the debates we see coming out with big data, where it's much more about hypothesis generation than hypothesis testing. So, you know, big data, one of the ways in which we're seeing knowledge, let's say, get made is by having massive aggregations of data and then patterns emerging from them. And what's going on with this blood story that I'm telling, especially in the way that these collections are being formed in the 50s and 60s, is really laying the groundwork for that in a way. Many of these scientists don't know exactly what they're looking for, but they know that having these large numbers of samples, having new technologies that enable slightly higher throughput of analysis, and they don't always do the analyses themselves. They outsource it to different labs around the world. They're also developing computer programs, early computer programming to make sense of how to aggregate this knowledge. And someone like Brooke Blum, Blumberg is a really great example. So Barry Blumberg is at the NIH. He starts to get really interested in this thing called the Australia antigen that he finds in some blood samples, and he travels around the world starting to collect more and more blood samples. He's described by another scientist as a have needle, will travel kind of guy, because he knows that he's going to find something, but he doesn't know what it is. And what he ultimately winds up discerning is the viral etiology of hepatitis B, which was really remarkable because he didn't know. It wasn't like he went out to figure out what causes hepatitis B. It revealed itself through these aggregations of samples. And the same thing or a similar thing happens in several other instances where the scientist doesn't really know what's being investigated, but having these massive numbers of samples enables a certain kind of searching or molecular search that can reveal new sorts of insights. So Newton Morton is such an interesting figure, not only because he and Jim Neal had worked together on the Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission and really didn't get along at all, but because Morton's views are increasingly marginalized. He makes a lot of good points. He has a lot of good insights, but he's also not against the salvage impulse. He just wants to do it his way. And there's a real contestation for authority that Neal is ultimately the better scientific diplomat, the better able to enroll the World Health Organization, the International Biological Program, and these other agencies to push his approach and his values. And he's better at enrolling allies and that powerful allies in that project as well. So, you know, this salvage impulse, both, I guess, yeah, presages this big data moment in really important ways, but also reflects, this is the other side of the question, really strange anxieties about degeneration, about the loss of the past, about what Claude Lévi-Strauss would call like the world on the wane. So these are scientists who have a kind of proto-environmentalist awareness. You know, Rachel Carson is writing about Silent Spring. Everybody is acutely aware and concerned about ionizing radiation. Neal's chief among them. You know, he's there in Hiroshima, Nagasaki, studying the survivors of the atomic bomb as a kind of natural laboratory. And he starts to realize that we just don't know, you know, what we're even measuring. We need this new kind of baseline. And so the language of baselines winds up becoming ubiquitous as a justification for why we're going to collect all of these things, why we're going to literally take stock of biological variation around the world. And so the baseline was another thing where I'm like, wow, this keeps coming up. I should look for the best article on the history of the baseline. And maybe it's out there, but I haven't found it yet. And I just think it's such a, it's an engineering term. And it becomes a kind of hard reset. It's like, okay, the bomb happened. We're in a completely different world. This is the era of like the risks, what, you know, Ulrich Beck calls the risk society, although he hadn't called it that yet. And people like Barry Commoner are really anxious about this idea that we are conducting inadvertently an experiment on ourselves and the effects won't be able to be revealed for years and years. And so if we don't act now to collect evidence of our own contamination, how are we going to even understand where we're at? It was this moment of real, like, biological disorientation. And that was really fascinating to me because the freezer then takes on this other realm. There's this effort to actually construct a freeze frame of this moment when it appears like things are maybe only going to get worse. And we want to know just how bad. And by we, it's these scientists, this cosmopolitan, largely Euro-American scientists that look to indigenous peoples as not pathological, but more normal, more in harmony with their environments. And it's that kind of updating of the ideal of the noble savage for the nuclear age that makes members of these communities such extra appealing subjects of salvage. And it's the salvage of their blood that will somehow provide salvation, not for those communities, but for the already maladapted, quote unquote, moderns who will have to persist in a world that they themselves have polluted and made toxic. And there's a strange logic there that is at the core of this emphasis on biological salvage. And it reproduces almost exactly the 19th century values of, ethnographic salvage. The sense that, in Darwin's time, like the anxiety of encroaching modernity leads people to look to the indigenous other as a way of measuring the distance of how far modernity's byproducts have gone. And that's a really insidious kind of narrative. And to reproduce that narrative right at a moment when the civil rights movement is happening in the United States, there's a Red Power movement, there's a real opportunity to think differently when anthropologists themselves are starting to become aware of the really dark colonial legacies of the field. Biologists who want to see themselves as like medical anthropologists just take that whole apparatus right on board. So in a way, I talk about the sense that they are also salvaging not only blood, but older ideas about race and empire and colonialism, I think quite unintentionally even, which doesn't make it better. But you see this way in which as one discipline shakes off or tries to free itself from a kind of mode of thinking that isn't serving its best purposes, that actually becomes an opportunity for a different discipline. And that is, to my mind, a really fascinating way that we see a persistence and a preservation of ideas that we really want to imagine could die.
I then asked Raiden to talk about one of the central actors toward the end of her story, a ship called the Alpha Helix. This also led her into a discussion of the ethical issues she grapples with in the book.
I have yet to fully exhaust the potential of that vessel, but the Alpha Helix was basically a boat, a floating laboratory. This was a moment when the biologists were trying to demonstrate that they too had need of big, expensive instruments. It wasn't just the physicists who needed it, the NSF sponsors it, but it's coordinated by Scripps in La Jolla, and they write in their publication, in their publicity materials, that this is going to be an instrument for big biology, and the goal is to get biologists out of the lab and into the field, to get them working together in teams. It's really this brilliant kind of, for the historian, microcosm of the values of post-war science funding, of what kinds of science did they want to see happening, and how could the ship become a kind of laboratory for the creation of new scientific forms of work, as well as, doing analyses in the field. And lots and lots of scientists travel on different voyages on the Alpha Helix. It's really, my understanding is that it was a really kind of lovely way to travel. It had a music room, it had paintings hanging, it, you know, had lots of different spaces to hang out for the crew. It wasn't a massive sort of cruise ship, but it wasn't a tiny dinky. There was an official crew that navigated, and then teams of scientists could stay on board. The idea being that they could reach places that they might not normally be able to reach, and they could really extend their networks and be able to extend also perhaps the reach of American Empire as well. So there were only three voyages that actually involved research on human communities, and I write about those three in the chapter. And because it was this big instrument, there's a particular kind of archival trail that I was able to trace. I mean, there are so many voyages, so many field trips that happen without the use of the ship, but the ship really crystallized the practices, really crystallized what it was that people thought they were doing, because they had to justify it in order to get use of the ship. Now, it turns out, and I've talked to a number of scientists who travel on the Arctic, not just for these voyages, but for others, that very little science per se or lab work happened on the ship. Its real value was as a floating freezer. It enabled people to keep materials cold across the cold chain to get them from one point to another, back to the centers of calculation where they would be archived and studied. The ship accelerated the pace of research. It enabled scientists to, hit several islands, perhaps, island communities, in a relatively short period of time, whereas in the past, it would have been a much more complicated undertaking. And it also gave them the kind of diplomatic authority of the United States, because once you start traveling along, ports and shipping, there's a whole different set of negotiations that need to happen or that do happen. Now, what I found particularly interesting was Carlton Gajicek's voyage on the Alpha Helix, because he kept meticulous diaries, he took photos, and he took film. And that was a really powerful opportunity to get some insight into what were the people whose blood were being collected making of this enterprise. This was a real challenge of this project for me. I had to make some difficult choices about whose voices I was going to be able to access. And these materials connected to the Alpha Helix helped me to get a better perspective on what those encounters looked like, what people were seeking. And what becomes very obvious and evident was that these were not communities that had never been contacted before. These were communities that had long been under colonial rule, had been involved in plantation labor, were struggling with the encroachment of an introduction of new kinds of extractive enterprises like mining, and were aware that the scientists could bring acute medical care, which they wanted. And so there's lots of footage of the team not only performing their anthropometric measurements and taking blood, but caring for small children, doing first aid exams on people. And you start to see that this was a much more complicated form of encounter than the scientists might have reported. And you start to see the ways in which this global scientific enterprise presents certain possibilities, shows some of the power of biomedicine in ways that communities wanted to access. Very rarely in the cases that I wrote about were these instances where people had absolutely no idea what was happening to them. However, they didn't anticipate, what they couldn't wrap their heads around, which no one could really wrap their heads around, was that the data that scientists, the materials that scientists were collecting about them were intended to be preserved that they were going to be frozen. And this really hit home to me when I found an informed consent document that Jim Neal had to fill out before he went to South America to work with members of the Chavante. He had to list what were the risks of the research he was doing. And the risks were limited in his mind to the fact that the puncture to take blood and puncturing the skin could, in very rare cases, lead to a complication. And that was the only risk. There was no sense that the blood could be used decades later to answer questions that the communities themselves were not interested in having answered. There was no indication that this was something that should be a source of concern, even as it was very clear in the minds of scientists that this was precisely what was so valuable about the blood. So the Alpha Helix not only provides me a way to see what this collection process with the freezers and with the values and the politics look like in practice, it's one of the rare opportunities I had in the archival record to get some insight into how these ethical questions that apply to all of us today, anyone who is encountering biomedicine, are really getting negotiated and worked out in this early period. And there's a really powerful moment when Gajasek is aboard the Alpha Helix, where they're collecting blood and they're partitioning it out, and they decide they don't need the hemoglobins, so they just dump it overboard. And the hemoglobin vials wash up back on the shore, right where he's just been. And the members of the communities are like, what are you doing? You're just like taking our blood and throwing it away. Like, you know, we don't understand. This is really upsetting. And Gajasek is really upset about it because he's embarrassed by it. And it's those kinds of moments of embarrassment or discomfort or friction that I found the most productive, and they certainly abound in the case of the Alpha Helix, in revealing what kinds of challenges are involved in implementing an entirely new kind of regime of knowledge production, especially one that involves cross-cultural encounter, and how little accountability there was. Scientists were really largely operating with their own sense of virtue, and I don't think many of them ever imagined that they would have to or be in a position to defend or explain their choices, not least of all because in their mind, these communities were already on their way towards what they would call extinction. So the fact that members of these communities, the communities haven't disappeared and in many cases are becoming influential and powerful has been something that contemporary biomedicine is reckoning with. What do these forms of accountability mean? What are the limits of informed consent? Is there really such a thing as informed consent? Is this a doctrine that is best suited to mitigating harm in these biomedical encounters? And here, I think there's a lot to be learned from Indigenous communities, not necessarily from their bodies, but from the ways in which they are able to articulate other ways of imagining what science can look like and what its goals can be. And so I hope that while I was not in a position to reconstruct the experiences of dozens and dozens of different Indigenous communities around the world, that people who are interested in these issues might find this book and might be able to use it to push these analyses further.
Raiden's work is definitely worthy of multiple audiences, and the two new projects she described to me sound like they might even lead to broader ones, though the main subject of the first will probably be a tough act to beat.
Sure. So I actually have two projects that I'm working on now, and they kind of come out of this one in different ways. So one that I've been working on quite a bit for the last year or so has to do with this question of biomedical futures. So after spending all this time looking at the way that scientists were trying to make a claim for what the future was going to be and going to need, I got really interested in science fiction and the ways in which similar kinds of claims get made there. In particular, I become really obsessed with Michael Crichton, creator of mass market fiction, for all kinds of reasons, not least of all, it turns out, he started out as a biological anthropologist at Harvard, hanging out with the scientists who I write about. And I was really interested in the ways in which his work kind of blurs this sense of fact and fiction and creates biomedical futures that are particularly attentive to fear. So questions about anxiety and risk, how we come to fear the future, what are the fears that are associated with emerging science and technology. And so I've been working on a book there where Crichton is one kind of delegate for the future of science and medicine, but I'm interested in what other kinds of subjectivities we might produce. And I'm interested in thinking about science fiction, not just as a set of cultural texts, but as objects, as things that circulate between the sort of mass market and the lab. I'm interested, I guess, in how science fiction colonizes the future. So there I'm reconstituting my interest in colonialism, science, ethics, and trying to write something about science fiction. The other project also comes out of this effort, this book on freezing life. I was thinking a lot in this book about people's efforts to keep life going, about immortality. And I started to realize that historians of biology or modern biology haven't done that much work yet on the question of death. And so I'm working also on a project of trying to think about finitude and how life scientists have thought about decay, degeneration, breakdown in the ways they make knowledge. And I'm also interested in looking alongside that at how ideas about death, decay, and breakdown are programmed into our information architecture. So I've sort of got my hands full across those domains, but I'm really excited to keep pushing on these questions and really try to make sense of what's scary about being alive and the ways in which we contort ourselves to not face those fears, even as we claim to be doing the real work of getting at the mysteries of life. So stay tuned.
Thanks for listening. This has been New Books in Science, Technology, and Society on the New Books Network.